Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we look back at some of the best stories, interviews, and essays we featured in 2006. There was the in-studio performance with local ukulele player, the Duke of Uke, Arlo Guthrie's visit as part of a Hurricane Katrina benefit, a profile of a woman who makes designer baby clothes for celebrities, and a strange electronic musical instrument called the Continuum Fingerboard, which has its roots at the U of I. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The Continuum Fingerboard is an electronic instrument that can produce sounds that many other instruments are capable of, yet it contains no keys, buttons, or strings. Instead, it relies on a complicated network of more than 200 aluminum rods, magnets, springs made from piano wire, and an internal computer, all contained beneath a fabric surface. The Fingerboard is the vision of University of Illinois Electrical and Computer Engineering professor Leopold Hocken, who has been perfecting the instrument for more than 20 years. In May, Jeff Bossert spoke with Hocken and also with one in a handful of artists who have only started mastering the instrument.
With the fingerboard hooked up to a large keyboard, Mark Smart, an electronics technician and local jazz guitarist, demonstrates a saxophone sound.
Basically, it's set up so that the left to right direction is controlling pitch, and then when you push harder, the pressure is controlling the volume and also the brightness of the sound to try to imitate the way the saxophone gets brighter when you blow harder on it. And then I also have the front back direction is controlling growl. If you play toward yourself, you get a clean sound, and if you play farther away, you get kind of a growl. And this actual sound is coming from this keyboard over here, which is basically a Windows PC in a box with the keyboard.
All the saxophone sound, whatever you want to emulate, it comes from the keyboard.
Yeah, the Continuum itself is a controller. It's not a synthesizer, so it just sends MIDI, which is a musical instrument digital interface, to control some other unit that actually produces the sound. It's really good for doing saxophone sounds and also for imitating Eddie Van Halen.
In order to produce a variety of sounds, Professor Leopold Hocken says he took his musical background and applied what he knew.
I wanted to do something in music and use my engineering skills doing it. And I'd been, my parents had me play violin all through my youth, and so I'm, you know, in violin playing, the vibrato is really important. Swells during notes, like crescendos during notes and glissandi and such, are all really important for expression. So I wanted to build an instrument that was keyboard-like, but had the same sort of expressive capabilities. And that's really where it came from.
Did you have a concept of what you wanted to do? Is this something that you saw the final product?
Well, actually, I tried a lot of different approaches. The idea of just having a surface where you place your fingers and you have to place them exactly to get the right pitch, sort of like on a fretless guitar or on a violin fingerboard, that idea I had really early on, but how to actually build electronics for it was tough. And I went through a lot of different designs. The challenge there from the electronic side is that when you play a vibrato, you're only moving your finger a fraction of a millimeter. And it has to be able to track that, and has to be able to track that for lots of different fingers. And that's, nobody's built a device that can do that yet.
And what kind of effects were you trying to pull off that would otherwise require holding down on some effect up here on a keyboard?
Right, and a keyboard player does that. A keyboard player has a pitch wheel, but that affects all the notes in the chord the same. It doesn't have the same sort of freedom. It sounds more electronic, more mechanical than it does if each finger is vibrating individually. And all these things that you can do in a fretless string instrument, you can also do on this instrument.
How long did it take to finish this?
Well, I guess I started, I was with a group of students building music synthesizers and keyboards, and also a pitch extractor, a thing that tracks singing. I was doing that in the early 80s when I was just finishing up my undergraduate and starting graduate school. So I think 84 is the first time I really wrote up the idea.
Can you name something that's easier to play now and what you wanted to emulate?
Oh, actually, easier to play is an interesting thing. You know, people always expect electronics to make their life easier, and in synthesizers, it's especially that way. One of the big frustrations for keyboard players is they sit down and play this instrument, doesn't play like a keyboard, and they don't like that. It's rare to find somebody who'll take the time and really realize that, no, this is a new instrument. I'm a keyboard player. If I were to start playing violin now, I could expect to spend years learning it. This isn't maybe not that big a leap, but it's a pretty big leap. Certainly the idea wasn't to make it easier. It was more to, like I say, to bring something of what you have, say, in the singing voice or in violin, in all those instruments where vibrato is so important and glissando is so important.
Fully utilizing the keyboard, Mark Smart records a bass line from the fingerboard, then adds to it. Professor Hawkins, as many others, have contributed to the fingerboard while he built it the last few years.
It was one of many projects. It was sort of a back burner thing. It was a big enough project that sort of went in fits and starts. But I would run into people and tell them about the idea, and people would have an idea of different kinds of sensing devices to use, different kinds of technology to use. And also, not being a very good performing musician myself, I really need a musician's feedback. Because almost all the improvements since like the last 6 or 7 years have been performers asking for changes. It's not like if you get a grand piano, but there's all these piano technique books that you can follow and you can go a step-by-step program and learn how to play piano. There's no such thing for this, so a lot of it's sort of your own discovery.
One of my most obvious questions, I mean, everybody's got to learn this thing by trial and error. I mean, it's not as if there's a continuum fingerboard teacher out there.
That's right, and also people all have very different playing styles. It's just now beginning that some of the continuum fingerboard players are imitating others, but that's really a new thing. It's still a small enough thing that most people develop their own playing technique, and most people play very different styles of music.
Yeah, how does this relate to what you do on campus?
Well, it's very nice. The interest of the students is very good. There's a lot of students, partly just because of iPods and such, that hear a lot of music, and then so they'll be fans of some of the bands. There's certainly some very very loyal Dream Theater fans here that I've run into. So the students like to see when I'm teaching a class, right? It's interesting for them that this band that they listen to willingly on their own, that they really enjoy, that I contributed something there. So I'm hoping that over time I can help nurture that, the next generation of people that are going to go out and do the cutting edge new things and get that mix of electrical engineering and music.
Dream Theater is a progressive metal band that uses the continuum fingerboard. Other more familiar names of those who have taken up the instrument include John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin fame and Terry Lawless, a keyboardist with U2. The fingerboard was also recently used for sound effects in Steven Spielberg's remake of War of the Worlds. Professor Hocken and Mark Smart have been to some trade shows with the instrument, but with a retail value between $3,000 and $5,500, depending on the model, Hocken says he doesn't want to add the expense of paying a distributor. And Hocken says he didn't design the continuum fingerboard to get rich, adding he has realistic expectations for an instrument that will take some time for others to learn about, not to mention figure out how to play. I'm Jeff Bossert. We'll be right back.
This is Sidetrack. David King was known in this area for a long time as a quirky comic strip artist. Recently, he added ukulele player to his resume. He performs under the name The Duke of Uke. In July, he stopped by the WILL studios for a few tunes. He also talked about playing the ukulele and his upcoming children's album. Here's an excerpt from that interview. We start first with his song, Be My Love. That is the Duke of Uke right here on Sidetrack with the tune Be My Love.
Aww.
You know, you are probably the most soulful ukulele singer I have ever heard.
Thank you.
Because usually they don't, usually hear that. You usually hear sort of the Hawaiian hapahala or in the Viper's case, the yodeling.
Yeah. I was a bit surprised. Because, when I got into ukulele music, I didn't really know that there were many out there at all. And then I discovered a whole bunch of them online, actually. But I found that most of them are doing one or two things. They're doing kind of funny songs, or they're doing old covers. And so I think that what I wanted to do with it, well, not what I wanted to do with it, what I've been doing with it, is, I wanted to do something a bit, funkier and more soulful than most of those people are doing. I think what it comes down to is that a lot of people think of the ukulele as kind of a joke instrument, like a funny instrument. But I think it's a very versatile, lovely instrument, you know. So I kind of wanted to bring that out about, you know.
Well, you do have an album out, mm-hmm. a CD, which actually is more than just you and the ukulele. There's a little bit more to that album.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's got, I mean, with it, I wanted to show the versatility of the ukulele. And so there's, like, you know, there's funk beats, there's a whole different kinds of styles, a lot of sound effects, and, you know, yeah, a lot of foo-fa-ra. Yeah, but I wanted to show the ukulele as a rock instrument, and as a soul instrument, and as a ballad instrument. You know.
Well, some of the stuff on your album is rather psychedelic,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is a strange genre for the ukulele. I guess maybe not with Tiny Tim and his, you know, his impact on ukulele music.
Yeah, but. Yeah, yeah. Tiny Tim was pretty far out. That's my favorite thing about Tiny Tim is reading these interviews with these just completely weird hippies, and even they in the 60s were like, that guy is far out. Like, they couldn't handle Tiny Tim. Like, no, he was just so far out. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I grew up, you know, listening to psychedelic music. I mean, the earliest music I remember hearing is Sgt. Pepper and things like that. And I just considered it imaginative music, kind of, in a way. So, yeah. But, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. Psychedelic you, okay. Yeah.
Well, you are working on another project.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, in a way, that touches on that psychedelic mood in a bit. And that's fantastical.
Does.
And that's children's songs.
You're absolutely right. In fact, you can get way farther out with kids' songs than you can with normal songs, you know. But, yeah, I've just been... I've been making these weird puppets. I just started making weird puppets. And I'm on MySpace, and I buy into the myth of MySpace, and that, like, if I get befriended by a bunny or, you know, some kind of stuffed monkey, I believe that I'm actually communicating with a monkey. I'm like, woo, you know, I've got a friend. I'm a friend with a monkey. I get very excited, and I have no concept of reality. So I started making puppets because I'm very charmed by them. And then from that came the idea of, like, you know, wouldn't it be great if there was a kid's show that was genuinely funny and where the music was good, as opposed to, like, Barney. I don't mean to knock Barney. I think they run him here, don't they? Okay, I can't knock Barney. We're gonna have to cut this out. But I'd say that a lot of the music in children's shows and albums, I don't think is as good as it could be. Or I just wanted to make really rocking, great children's music. So,
and you're gonna play one for us right now.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if there are any dinosaurs out there listening, but this goes out to you folks.
It's the Duke of Uke. Otherwise known as Dave King and his ukulele, right here on Sidetrack.
This goes out to all you dinosaurs in Radioland.
Uncouth like me. My favorite dinosaur, he likes it in the tub. He likes the yellow ducks, he likes to scrub the vet. There's no other friend I love as much as him, my dinosaur, yeah. My favorite dinosaur, he likes to sleep in late, and he likes the ducks and geese down there in Crystal Lake. He don't like broccoli, goes for wedding cake, just like me. Let me tell you now, he keeps me company. Who could ask for more? He's a true friend indeed. Yeah, he's my favorite dinosaur. So, oh yeah, my favorite dinosaur. My favorite dinosaur. My favorite dinosaur. My favorite dinosaur. Well, he's my favorite dinosaur.
That was David King, otherwise known as the Duke of Uke. You're listening to Sidetrack. There are those who consume books, and for an afternoon in Urbana, there was an event where one could actually consume books. It was the latest addition to what's become an annual event around the world, an April Fool's Day tribute to gourmets, artists, and bibliophiles everywhere. From the April program, Tom Rogers takes us to the Edible Books Festival at the University of Illinois' Illini Union.
Author Jean-Anthelme Briot-Savarin told his contemporaries, "Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you what you are." You could call his most famous book, The Physiology of Taste, a sort of early 19th century Food Network program. He was born on April 1st, a perfect time, thought archivist and critic Judith Hofberg, sitting at a Thanksgiving dinner with a few artist friends, to mix Savarin's interest in food with her interest in literature, and do it whimsically.
We're sitting around, of course, mellow with wine and food, and talking about books, and one thing led to food, and then I put the two together just in lightning speed, and said, gee, wouldn't it be an interesting idea to do something about edible books? And then we all went home.
The next year, 2000, Hofberg held her first Edible Books High-Low Tea in Los Angeles. 6 years later, it's an event in 15 countries, and U of I librarians have now taken the idea and run with it.
Pretty much reached your decisions here?
I'm just now going to put these down. Let's see.
You may know Doyle Moore as the chef in residence on our talk program, Focus 580. He was also the judge of the first CU Edible Books Festival. It was a challenge of wit as much as cooking and decorating skills. Some entries were simply book-shaped cakes. Others were more exotic, like sushi.
Then, well, no, this is not sushi. Check that out again. It's the dead seaweed scrolls. And so it's an extraordinarily good pun on the Dead Sea Scrolls and on sea and seaweed. And I find this particularly attractive because, again, it pushes some things a little bit farther than you would think about it.
There were small meat and cheese hors d'oeuvres in the shape of books and book titles in the shape of toast.
Putting the letters on top of a piece of toast and then toasting it, and then it comes out with the letters in negative, is very amusing because that's the whole abstract concept of photography.
The creator of The Toast of the Town happens to be a photographer. Down the table is a hollow cake that at first glance may have been damaged.
I mean, the book is controversial. It's on the Da Vinci Code.
Oh yes.
But it seems to be cracked.
Well, it does seem to be cracked. I'm not so sure that was an intention. I don't think so by the form of the crack, but it could be to crack the Da Vinci Code. It's smashed in at the top, but then it's not destroyed around the edges anywhere. So I can't imagine if something dropped on it or if somebody cracked the code.
It's a mystery.
So it is a mystery.
Just like the book.
Exactly. We'll not know.
Contest organizer Sue Searing entered a homemade pizza. Swirled in the center in linguine was the Dewey Decimal System number for pizza. A black olive served as the decimal point. These types of events are natural draws for librarians, but Searing says the whole community turned out.
About half of these entries are from art students, and the other half are from librarians, community members, students in other departments. We really weren't sure who was going to show up, and we're pretty excited to have this much interest. That's why we're holding it at the Union rather than at the library. Plus, of course, you're not supposed to eat in the library.
Doyle Moore's winner was a dough-based recreation of a quipu, a string of knotted cords that the Incans used as a sort of mnemonic to help them in storytelling. He was surprised that for an April Fool's event, most of the entries were not really foolish.
There's a lot of thought that goes into making the choice. Then the object itself can take its own humor, but there's a lot of attention paid to details, and I did not expect that careful a consideration, quite frankly.
But Moore and the festival's visitors did expect the eventual demise of this year's edible books as an afternoon snack. For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
Still to come on the program, celebrity baby clothes, old wax cylinders brought into the digital age, and Arlo Guthrie rides the city of New Orleans. Stay tuned. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Most people today are familiar with older recording media, like LPs, cassettes, 8-tracks, and 45s. But few people remember one of the earliest forms of mechanical recording, the wax cylinder. David Soibert is trying to change that. He is the curator of the Performing Arts Collection and director of the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I talked with him in April about the technology needed to bring these cylinders back to life and the history of some of the recordings. Let's talk about the technical side of taking these old recordings and making them digital and thereby offering them up to a whole new generation of listeners and enthusiasts.
The first step that we took in terms of preserving and transferring these cylinders was to find appropriate playback equipment. The vintage equipment is what they call acoustic equipment, which meant that it didn't use electricity, didn't have speakers or anything like that. It was just played back through a horn, and it was inappropriate to play them back on vintage equipment because of the damage that can be done, and also because the sound quality is interesting, but not really, it doesn't capture all of the information that's in the grooves of these recordings. And so we've found a machine called the Archaea phone, which was developed by a French designer that plays back cylinder recordings electrically, and it plays back all varieties of them, whether from different manufacturers. You get basically an analog output, just like you would from a regular phonograph turntable or something like that. But then you can take that analog output and you can put it through an analog to digital conversion process then and create a digital sound file of the recording. And so that was the basic step that we took then to digitize the materials.
And you also did something to clean up the sound quality as well, correct?
Right. We keep an archival master file of every recording in the collection. So there's about 6,000 that we've transferred now. And then we also create what we call informally here a cleaned-up file, and we feed it through some computer equipment manufactured by the Cedar Company in England that takes out the pops and the clicks and things like that. That's Cedar equipment is commonly used for a lot of restoration projects and film work and things like that. And so we did create a cleaned up file then from that. And then from that cleaned up file, then we created other files for distribution online, such as the MP3 file and the streaming QuickTime file.
So let's take a listen to one of these MP3s. This is Gondolier and Temptation Rag. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that one?
That cylinder is interesting for a couple of reasons, and it's illustrative of several things that were going on at this time. And the first is that it's a banjo recording, which, you know, you don't hear a lot of banjo records these days, but certain instruments recorded really well with the acoustic process, the acoustic recording process. And banjo is one of them, so you just had this huge proliferation of banjo recordings back then. And also, this cylinder is interesting because it was recorded by a U.S. Everlasting company, which was in Cleveland. And, you know, we think of, you know, Columbia Records and Edison Records and Victor Records, but there were all little labels, too, around the country. There were labels in Chicago, and there were labels in Cleveland and elsewhere. And U.S. Everlasting made these cylinders for a few years. And this one in particular just sounds incredible. And it's hard to say how well that'll come over on the radio. But, you know, the quality for this is a 1909 cylinder is really just astounding. And it shows just how advanced, really, that the cylinder format was at this time, which for really the first decade of the 20th century, the cylinder format actually sounded better than the disc format, which then really changed in this time and into the teens when the discs actually kind of caught up in terms of sound quality.
That's David Soibert, curator of the Performing Arts Collection and director of the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project at the University of California, Santa Barbara. You're listening to Sidetrack. In August, we were introduced to a mother and daughter whose trip to buy shoes was something out of the ordinary. You see, Claire Williams, like just about every other 15-year-old girl, loves shoes. But as her mother, Deb Aronson, explains, finding the perfect fit can be hard when you have an artificial leg.
It's funny the kinds of things you take for granted when you have two legs, like wearing high heels. Plenty of women complain about wearing them. but you can be sure most have at least a couple pairs in their closet. My 15-year-old daughter, on the other hand, has yearned all her life for high heels and never once owned a pair. That's because she has an artificial leg, which, it turns out, can really cramp a good shoe fetish. You know how when your baby is born and everyone always kind of jokes about counting all the fingers and toes? Well, it was no joke in our case. When our daughter was born, she had all her digits, but she was missing most of one thigh bone, so her left leg was half the length of her right, with a little foot hanging off the end. I can hear you now. Oh, what did you do? How could you handle that? Well, you can't ever know until you're faced with something similar, but I always tell people that we just did what any parent would do. We stepped up to the plate, waggled our proverbial bat, and set out to figure out how to help our child in whatever way we could. The really cool thing was, Claire didn't think she was imperfect. And, of course, in fact, we, like all new parents, knew she was totally perfect. Bright eyes, strong muscles, thick dark hair, sunny smile. Just beautiful. After researching our options, which involved both medical library research and talking to tons of parents in the same or a similar boat, we arranged for her to have surgery at Shriners Hospital in St. Louis. The surgery enabled her to wear a prosthetic leg with a real foot at the end, instead of a little lift with a hockey puck where the foot would be. The first time we put Claire's prosthetic leg on her, complete with a brand new snow-white sneaker on the foot, she looked down and said, "Two shoes!" She was 15 months old. I mark that as the beginning of Claire's little shoe fixation. As time went on, she went for more and more gaudy shoes. There were the sneakers painted in psychedelic colors. There were the golden glittery shoes and the red glittery shoes. But this is no more than any, or I should say most girls, would want. The problem came as she got older. Claire is not blessed with dainty feet, neither her flesh and blood one nor her plastic and metal one. Even if she could squeeze her good foot into a pump or two, like Cinderella's sisters, her other foot just wouldn't give, refusing to squeeze into a shoe that wasn't the right fit. So Claire channeled her shoe fetish into sneakers, Converse to be precise. She owns two pairs, stole another pair from her little brother, even though they are two sizes too big for her, and will wear them through snow and sleet, uphill and down dale, despite also owning some shoes that have better support. Speaking of lousy support, she also wears flip-flops, black, from Old Navy. Flip-flops were, in fact, our first shoe breakthrough. Oh, how Claire wished she could wear flip-flops. When she learned from other teenage girl amputees about the existence of the split-toe foot, which has a gap between the big toe and the next one down, so you can wear flip-flops just like anybody else, she had me call Brian, her prosthetist at Shriners, that very day. She is now on her third pair of flip-flops. She puts lots of miles on those babies. So up until now, that has been the extent of Claire's shoe wardrobe, Converse and flip-flops. Not that she didn't constantly try on other shoes, not that she didn't gaze longingly any time we strolled by a shoe department, but it just wasn't going to happen. Recently, Brian changed all that. He presented her with a new kind of foot. This foot, in addition to the requisite split toe, was much narrower, more like a typical female foot. And the pièce de résistance, it had an adjustable ankle, so she could point the toes down a bit to accommodate wearing a heel. Claire hugged Brian so hard she almost knocked him down. Then we went straight to the mall. There, Claire tried on stilettos, she tried on dressy ballet slippers, and she tried on what we called Minnie Mouse shoes. All the women gave her knowing glances as she stumbled around trying to get her sea legs. Or would that be stiletto legs? But it was a guy manning the Origins boutique nearby who really cheered us on. His real job was giving women advice on skin care and makeup. With his own perfect skin, chiseled cheekbones, styled hair, and polished clothes, he was an advertisement for the power of those Origins products. When he wasn't helping his own customers, he was watching and smiling as Claire stumbled around on her new heels. Catching our eye, he grinned again, miming the correct walk for us. Hips swaying, arms akimbo, with the backs of his wrists on his hip bones, he sashayed around his boutique, his face lit up like he was on Star Search. "Walk on your balls, walk on your balls," he would exhort in a high-pitched voice, giddy with excitement. Claire smiled gamely, smothering a snicker at his innuendos, and kept trying on shoes. She was kind of surprised at how much these shoes she'd coveted for so long, hurt. "These are not that comfortable," she looked up at me, a little shocked and wounded, like I'd been keeping secrets from her. Still, Origins guy kept encouraging her, at least until he had to go on break. We stayed, trying on shoe after shoe. Eventually, we found a pair that was sufficiently chic for Claire and stable for me. After waiting for our pal to come back and admire our selection, Claire and I both left satisfied. At last, just like Cinderella, we found the perfect fit.
Deb Aronson and her daughter Claire live in Urbana. This is Sidetrack. Not only do movie stars and other celebrities wear clothes that stand out in a crowd, but also, thanks to a woman in Taylorville, so do their children. In March, Jiffy Johnson talked with Nicole Pugh, who owns Bundles of Blossoms, a boutique featuring luxury baby goods.
I pretty much made them for celebrities. They're real big on non-mass-produced items. I have a luxury line, and that's for celebrities primarily because the price is so high, but I also like to make mainstream boutique goods to sell to the public.
But the one-of-a-kind appeal to the stars.
Yes.
But then how did you get the access? Because you're here in Taylorville.
There was a press release from my marketing company, which is what they do is they, you know, tell all the new creations that I'm designing. They put that out in the press. Well, Google picked it up, Yahoo, MSN, and a company out in New York City, the Creative Coalition, founded by Christopher Reeves, picked up on this luxury designer here in the Midwest. Well, the company working for them, who puts these gigantic galas on for the stars, started looking into my lines and invited me to be one of the top 40 designers out in Bel Air last December. And so that's where I started making a lot of connections. I started working with other vendors. We were able to exchange, you know, information, and it's been a ride. I got real friendly with a lot of celebrities out there as well. Sharon Lawrence from NYPD Blue and Desperate Housewives by far has been, we've become friends. I talk to her about every 2 weeks. I worked 2 days straight with Joe Pantoliano from The Sopranos. Rhoda from Mary Tyler Moore with Valerie Harper. Paul DeJorio from Paul Mitchell Hair Products. Gary Busey was another one. It was incredible.
What was the process of working with these stars? Was it easy, challenging?
They were a lot easier to work with than I thought. I had a couple of them, which, without mentioning names, that they portrayed the star image. But for the most part, they were very down to earth. I mean, you feel like, you know, you could welcome them into your home and sit down and have coffee at the coffee table. I mean, they were very relaxed. You would never even know they were a celebrity. At one point during that gala, we were walking around and, you know, just bumping shoulders with these people, and I never even thought about it, who they were. After so many hours, it didn't even feel like they were Hollywood movie stars in the least.
Being far from either New York or Hollywood, does that present some logistical problems for you?
You know what? Technology is great. You can get a lot done through the computer and through the telephone. The Postal Service and UPS has been phenomenal. One thing good about what I do in my website, there's so many variations of my business. A lot of people online carry my products too, who also market to celebrities. So therefore, name recognition constantly. Heidi Klum, for instance, went through another website seeking Bundles of Blossoms product lines for her baby, which at the time she thought was a girl, but ended up surprising her, and it ended up being a little boy. And she went through another website trying to find me and ended up purchasing.
If you tried this 30 years ago, it would have been difficult, but now it's easy.
I think you would have had to live either in Hollywood or New York to accomplish what I've accomplished today. There's a lot of back and forth communication. Emails are quick. Type something in, you get the question answered, they make the decision, process the order, or they don't process the order.
Do you actually design the clothes with the star's input, or do you make the item and then they see what you've got?
I design the item that I think represents them. The Britney bag that I designed exclusively for Britney Spears. I'm very familiar with Hollywood. I'm very familiar with Britney and what she likes, what her style is, what her fashion is. So what I do is when I'm laying in bed at night or just got a minute to think, I think of what I could create for that person, for who they are. And then I create and then present. And I usually capture it.
When would you pinpoint your moment of inspiration for all this?
I had a really traumatic pregnancy with my third son, and I'd ruptured. I remember the nurses telling everyone there's no pulse, and my husband crying and holding this baby. And so after that, I survived, obviously, and the baby was fine. I had to go home and recuperate for weeks. I mean, the Alter Society came in and brought meals, you know, farm women who had many babies, they knew how devastating it was. Got to watch a lot of Oprah, and I heard a lot of inspiring stories from moms to millionaires, and that was kind of the let's get on with this and let's do something, life's too short. It was just a very big awakening for me.
So you decided that you needed to take an idea and move with it.
Take an idea, and it had to be something I was passionate about. If you don't have the passion, you cannot succeed. This business, and as much as I've loved it, has been hard. I think, okay, I'm going to give it up. Then what will I design? So the passion's there to keep moving with this.
That was Jiffy Johnson talking with Nicole Pugh of Taylorville, who owns Bundles of Blossoms, a boutique featuring luxury baby goods. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. In January, Jim Meadows featured a story on folk singer Arlo Guthrie and other performers when they stopped in Urbana to raise money for New Orleans musicians who lost instruments, equipment, and performing venues to Hurricane Katrina. It's one of the many stories of hope that came from the Katrina disaster, and it's also a story about family, both biological and musical.
Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son.
Arlo Guthrie performed his hit City of New Orleans for the news media, seeing him off in Chicago on his benefit tour because he's a celebrity. But he says he wasn't supposed to be one. Arlo says neither the song, written by the late Steve Goodman, or his recording of it was meant to be a hit.
First of all, in those days, radios wouldn't play anything that was over 2.5 minutes. And City of New Orleans is a lot longer than that. I mean, if it was 2:31, they wouldn't play it on popular music, you know, radio stations. And it was very different in its sound. It was very simple. It was a plaintive kind of song, a song about the disappearing way of life in America. No one ever looked for those kinds of songs to be popular.
Arlo says City of New Orleans comes from a period in the 1960s and 70s when singer-songwriters like Goodman and himself were able to make a dent in pop music culture. But he says he's used to mostly working under the radar of the music industry. Most of the musicians who joined Arlo for the tour are still under the radar of commercial success, like it or not. They included Arlo's son Abe and his rock band Xavier, and daughter Sarah Lee Guthrie and her husband and musical partner, Johnny Irian.
Yeah, I performed in New Orleans before, actually at Tipitina's where we're going to play. I'm real excited to go back down. And just like Sarah Lee was saying, you know, we're all giving. We're all playing for free. And hopefully, you know, the tour will help bring awareness that New Orleans still needs help. You know, Arlo felt like, what can we do as musicians? And we just followed right in with the way he was thinking. It was a great idea.
We've been doing a song called Exploration. That's actually the title track to our last record. And, you know, it's got some really nice lines in there that I think kind of sum up what we're doing.
As I look up at the stars, exploration on Mars, there's a lot of left here to do. People asking us for change, people sleeping in the streets, politicians still don't have a clue. Looking out my door at the downtrodden for sure, but they ain't in their neck of the woods.
While members of the Guthrie family have performed in New Orleans only rarely or not at all prior to the tour, singer and songwriter Jack Nielsen is a New Orleans resident who left town as part of the mandatory evacuation but is now back in the city.
I'm a lucky evacuee, as I keep saying. I feel like a really fortunate evacuee that, I mean, the stories around me, there's thousands and thousands of stories around me that so much more severe, and it's just all relative. You know, I have friends in different parts of the city. It really depended on where you lived. Some places that normally flood with heavy rains didn't necessarily flood from Katrina this time. And some that never get it just really got flooded.
Nielsen, who was the opening act at the Guthrie concert in Urbana, handed me a copy of his 2003 CD, Here I Go Again, and pointed out track one.
Hello, My Old Friend is the first cut that, you know, I wouldn't have gotten this CD made unless it was for an old friend that believed in me enough to say, you need to cut a CD. You never did this your whole life. Why didn't you ever cut a CD?
Hello, my old friend. It's good to see you again. I missed your point of view. Come on over my house tonight. Maybe we'll knock down a few till we get it right. Passes so quickly, like it was all yesterday. But I know you'd look the same. Such a wonder, but it ain't no crying shame, 'cause we made the best go far.
Also performing with Arlo Guthrie in Urbana were the Byrne sisters, Jeannie, Annie, and Marie. Their music features close vocal harmonies that Annie Byrne says come to them naturally.
Performing with my sisters, we go into a natural, like, unspoken form. Like, we can just, like, last night we sang backups to songs we'd never heard before. So we'd heard them once, and then we go into a form of that we're used to, which is like high, middle, and low, and just sing. And it's powerful to sing with your family.
Come, come, whoever you are, this caravan has no despair, even though you have broken your vows, perhaps 10,000 times.
That Burns Sisters performance is on a CD on the Philo label that the sisters handed me entitled Tradition. It's mostly a collection of Christmas songs, but that particular cut features words by the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, whose death is commemorated just a few days before Christmas on December 17th. Another musician I spoke with on the Arlo Guthrie tour took the role of a sideman in the Urbana concert, but Gordon Titcomb could be heard singing one of his songs a few nights earlier on the train carrying the musicians from Chicago to Kankakee.
My granddad was a railroad man. He drove the trains around. My daddy, he sold tickets till they closed the station down. Now the tracks are shone like silver have turned to rusty brown. 30 years ago, the last train rolled through town.
The Last Train is the title cut of the CD Gordon Titcomb released in 2005, his first solo effort after many years as a studio musician and sideman.
It's sort of a mournful look, although it's not a mournful song, at the demise of the railroads. If you notice on the cover, there's sort of a picture of a derelict train station, and I'm standing with my guitar and banjo and luggage looking at my watch, and it's, you know, the intention of this photograph is to show the viewer that the train probably is not coming, and by the looks of the tracks and the station itself, the train hasn't been through there in an awfully long time.
I'm riding on the city of New Orleans, thinking about the Wabash Cannonball and its midnight fire. Hear that lonesome freight train whistle call.
Arlo Guthrie plays guitar on this and two other songs on Gordon Titcomb's CD, which is sold through Arlo's own music company, Rising Sun. Arlo formed Rising Sun in the 1980s and hasn't recorded for a major label since. He says growing up, the son of the famous but uncommercial folk singer Woody Guthrie has shaped his own idea of musical success.
It was never meant to be popular music. It was always, I think, meant to be in the tradition of the kind of people who were telling their life story or telling the stories of other people. Writers who sort of capture a time and a place and an essence of where we are and who we are and where we're going and what we're doing. They become part of the soundtrack of people's lives.
Arlo Guthrie's City of New Orleans tour lasted for 8 performances over 2 weeks from Chicago to New Orleans. Later in January, Arlo resumes his regular touring, marking the 40th anniversary of the events chronicled in Alice's Restaurant. But he's still raising money to help New Orleans musicians. You can find out more at his website at arlo.net. I'm Jim Meadows.
All the towns and people seem to fade into a bad dream, and the steel rails still ain't heard the news. The conductor sings his songs again, the passengers will please refrain. This train.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.